Proceed.
May it please the court, Mark Dunkel on behalf of appellant Lawrence DeSabatino, individually and as assignee of Wilmington Trust Company and appellant Sunrise Ventures, LLC. The Court of Chancery erred in dismissing plaintiff's complaint for four main reasons. Fraud and fiduciary misconduct equitably told the applicable statute of limitations and dismissal was premature. Second, denial of the remedy of equitable rescission before a trial on the merits was also premature. Third, dismissal of the 2002-2003 loan contract claims with prejudice ignored the well-pled resulting damage claims and was also void for lack of jurisdiction. And fourth, failure to consider evidence of the party's intent under the ambiguous 2004 contract provisions regarding signature under seal was error. The plaintiff's claims were not time-barred because they were told by Kiernan's fraud and fiduciary misconduct, and the applicable statute of limitations must be told. The complaint and the exhibits show the formation of a joint venture between Kiernan and DeSabatino well before September 17, 2004, establishing Kiernan as a fiduciary of DeSabatino.
Is that based on an actual agreement or just negotiations?
Your Honor, there is evidence of an agreement contained first in the complaint. There's an allegation of an oral agreement reached August 6, 2004, and then an email authored by Mr. Kiernan on August 8, 2004. That email contains evidence of a joint venture, an agreement between Kiernan and DeSabatino to form a business enterprise. Not only did they form that enterprise on August the 8th, 2004, but then they took concrete steps immediately thereafter to establish a joint venture.
You're arguing that it was error, legal error, for the court not to to find that there was no joint venture created until the formal joint venture agreement was signed.
Correct.
And your argument is that there was some evidence of an intent to create a joint venture before that time.
Yes, Your Honor. And the error was.
It may be one thing for parties to to have some intent to create a joint venture at a point in time when they actually sign off on a formal agreement, and quite another to have an intent to form one before they sign off on an oral agreement. So if we're to find that there was legal error here, what's the rule of law that applies?
Yes, Your Honor. And the rule is that, of course, the formation of a joint venture is a fact inquiry. Evidence of the party's intent to form a business enterprise, to combine their skills, money, and take a risk to produce a profit. We believe that evidence was pled in the complaint, both from the direct pleadings and inferences from the complaint. One of those direct inferences is this. In August of 2004 and before September 17, 2004, Mr. Kiernan and Mr. DeSabatino applied jointly for financing for their venture, for their project, from the Wilmington Trust Company. And that loan was formally approved by Wilmington Trust Company on September 16, 2004.
Why does that make a joint venture?
It does, Your Honor, because it indicates that the parties worked together towards their common venture goal, which was to purchase and develop the property. The bank issued its commitment to Kiernan, DeSabatino, and to what they recognized as their joint venture, Sunrise Ventures, LLC, on September 16, 2004.
So there's no requirement of a writing?
There is no requirement of a writing for a joint venture, Your Honor. It is a case-by-case factual analysis of the party's intent.
Let me go at it from a different perspective for a moment. Let's say you've got two parties who are negotiating an agreement, and they go back and forth, and everything seems to be going fine, and they're agreeing on basic terms and moving forward and taking some steps, including applying for loans or whatever. And then for one reason or another, they never enter into an agreement. You know, they never sign a contract. They never basically formalize the joint venture. Is it your position that from the time they start reaching agreements on various aspects of it until the time everything falls apart, there is a joint venture?
Well, Your Honor, it's, of course, it's a question of fact, and the real point of our argument is that that question cannot be decided at this stage, the motion to dismiss. The question of fact is exactly what you've identified. What was the intention of the parties? Did they actually form that venture to proceed and pursue a common goal? That intention is not simply required to be expressly found, but the cases hold that can be implied. And that's where the Chancery Court failed to permit an inquiry into the formation of the joint venture. There is evidence.
Two questions, Mr. Dunkel. Is your appeal, does it rest entirely on the argument that there was a joint venture created before the actual agreement was signed?
Well, Your Honor, the...
That's a yes or no.
My argument as to the fiduciary duty...
If we reject your argument that a joint venture was formed at some point before the formal agreement was signed, does your appeal vanish, or does it still survive?
Well, it still survives, Your Honor.
So this is not an essential issue for you.
The creation of a fiduciary duty is an essential issue before
yes.
September 17th. On that issue, fiduciary duty creation before September 17th, that is an essential issue.
So if we were to hold that there wasn't a fiduciary duty created before that time, then you lose. Is that right?
Well, Your Honor, it changes the standard for equitable tolling.
No, you've just told me that this is an essential issue. Is it essential for your appeal to survive or not?
On the issue of equitable tolling and the creation of a fiduciary duty, it is essential.
Okay.
And that duty, that creation of that relationship can be implied, and that is found in the Wilmington Trust bank loan approval of September 16th.
Okay, well, before you go any further, I understand that this is a pivotal issue for you. I'm trying to understand the nature of the inference that you would have us draw. Let's assume that before the parties entered into this agreement formally, they were negotiating but took no steps to apply for a loan. Would there be a basis for an inference under those facts?
There would, Your Honor, because the email that Kiernan authored identified that the property would be held by a venture joining his LLC and DeSabatino's LLC. So there is some evidence that they intended to form a business enterprise.
At some point in the future. So you're saying that the fact that they acted together to apply for a loan before they actually had a formal agreement is not critical?
No, I think that the fact that they acted together is part of the implication that there was a joint venture and is essential for the trial court to
right.
develop an evidentiary
record.
Right,
but if we were just to take that element out of the picture, you're arguing that there still would be a basis to infer an intent to create a joint venture before there was a formal agreement?
There's a pled fact of that intention. That is correct, Your Honor, from the email itself. The critical date of September 17th, 2004, was selected in error by the Vice Chancellor as the only possible joint venture commencement date. On September 16th, the Wilmington Trust Company recognized that a venture existed by issuing its formal loan commitment for $4.3 million to Kiernan DeSabatino and a venture they called Sunrise Ventures LLC, of which Kiernan was not a member on September 16th, 2004. So there was a multitude of points of evidence that would lead to an inference, if not facts, that a joint enterprise had been formed between DeSabatino and Kiernan. It was recognized by Wilmington Trust on September 16th, 2004. Also, it's unreasonable for the Vice Chancellor to conclude that a purchase loan could have been applied for, reviewed, and approved and dispersed all on September 17th, 2004. There must have been activity in concert between Kiernan and DeSabatino before that date. Kiernan was not just the seller of the property. He was the co-buyer, the co-venturer, and essentially partner of DeSabatino. A joint venture, or as the case law more aptly describes, a joint adventure, is determined on a case-by-case and factual analysis of the party's intent, both implied and expressed.
It's you're arguing that a joint venture was formed before the actual agreement was signed, and that argument is critical to your case, as I understand it, because if there was a joint venture before the actual agreement was entered into, then there was a fiduciary relationship.
That is correct.
And the fiduciary relationship created a duty on the part of, trying to remember.
Mr. Kiernan.
Kiernan.
Mr. Kiernan, Your Honor.
To disclose the substance of the 2002 study that was done. Is
correct.
That right?
That is correct.
Would there not have been an identical duty immediately after the agreement was signed?
There would have been, Your Honor. And as alleged in the complaint, when Kiernan and DeSabatino joined formally in Sunrise Ventures, LLC, they owed fiduciary duties to each other in that venture. The fraud purported perpetrated by Kiernan included fraudulent concealment. So there is a separate basis for asserting equitable tolling besides fiduciary duty. But, yes, he would have had a fiduciary duty to disclose the true facts of the condition of the property on September 17, 2004, and thereafter. But that duty did arise earlier. And if it was critical for him to make an honest disclosure before September 17th, because of the circumstances surrounding the settlement, there was no suspicion, and DeSabatino was really on no inquiry notice of any problems or environmental concerns with the property. The complaint adequately alleges tolling of the statute of limitations based upon fraudulent concealment and breach of fiduciary duty.
Well, you say he wasn't under any notice. He may not have had actual knowledge, but he had inquiry notice, didn't he?
Well, Your Honor, the trial court focused on the existence of the Phase 1 report and wrongly presumed that it was a fatal red flag and concluded that DeSabatino was on inquiry notice. But inquiry notice requires some suspicion and an examination of those circumstances. None of the circumstances surrounding the acquisition of the property raised a suspicion that DeSabatino was being defrauded, that the environmental representations made by Mr. Kiernan, his co-venturer, his partner, and the seller were fraudulent. In fact, the circumstances surrounding the acquisition of the property would have given Mr. DeSabatino comfort rather than caution. By its very nature, a Phase 1 environmental study is a neutral document. It does not, in and of itself, or the existence of a study, signal that a property has environmental problems.
Let me stop you there, because let's assume that that's correct. I'm told that there's been a Phase 1 study on the property I'm about to acquire. Nobody tells me that it was a study that found something wrong, right? But I don't have any reason to be concerned because Phase 1 studies can come out clean, right?
Correct.
So the fact that there's a Phase 1 study itself doesn't warn me that there's a problem and that I should be investigating. However, doesn't the inquiry notice go farther than just somebody had to warn you and you had to neglect the warning in the sense that you were given information that was available to you and you chose not to look at it? And now you're coming back and saying, well, nobody warned me that if I had looked at it, I would have found something bad, and therefore I was under no duty to look at documents that relate to the property that I was purchasing.
And, Your Honor, inquiry notice requires more than opportunity. It requires some suspicion that you've been defrauded, because in this case there was fraudulent concealment. So in addition to the identified Phase 1, there was also a written environmental representation by Mr. DeSabatino in September 17th. The property has no environmental problems. Mr. Kiernan gave that representation not just as an arm's-length seller, as characterized by the Vice Chancellor, but as a partner, as a co-purchaser of the property, and as a future fiduciary and member of an LLC. From that circumstance, DeSabatino draws comfort. The Wilmington Trust Company appraised the property as suitable for residential development. that does not raise suspicion that there is an environmental problem. So the Phase 1 itself does not put DeSabatino on inquiry notice that there may be an environmental problem because it is a neutral document. Just as a meets and bounds survey, its mere existence does not put the recipient on notice that there may be a boundary line problem. The circumstances are what must be examined in, by the trial court on a factual record.
So you're saying that an investor who is about to invest millions of dollars to be a part of a joint venture to develop real estate is not imprudent in any respect by failing to look at a document that involved at least a preliminary environmental survey of the property involved? Is that
no, right? Your Honor, if that investor is relying on his partner and the information that his partner provides. His partner provided representations and warranties that the property was clean. The test for inquiry notice...
Where do you get the representation and warranty? You mean you're talking about Section 11?
In the 2004 agreement.
Of the 2004 agreement?
Yes.
Well, let's test that because that is a very tightly worded representation and warranty. It says, to the best of seller's knowledge, there has not been manufactured, stored, or deposited by seller, or to the best of seller's knowledge by anyone else, on the property any hazardous or toxic substance.
That's correct, Your Honor. And it's the anyone else language that captures the disclosures in the 2002 Phase 1 environmental report, because that report was prepared before Mr. Kiernan acquired the property, but it gave indications that there had been deposits of contaminated material on the property. And as alleged in the complaint, Mr. Kiernan also cleaned up the property and removed surface evidence. So that warranty does provide confirmation that there is no environmental contamination or else there is no known environmental contamination.
Did your client, seek relief under Section 11 of the agreement? Did he claim a violation of that contractual provision?
In the complaint, Your Honor, although the Court of Chancery found that the complaint was time barred. I see that I am into my rebuttal time, but I would like to touch on a few minor points before I sit down. The 2002 and 2003 contract claims adequately pled diminution in security value as damages and should not have been dismissed with prejudice by the Court of Chancery. That contract obligation was by Moore and Kiernan, executed in 2002 and 2003. It was a continuing obligation. They made representations and warranties that the property was not contaminated. That obligation existed in May and June of 2004 when the bank was appraising the property, when the bank was approving the loan, and when the bank approved the 2004 loan. Those representations were false. Those contracts were in breach. The bank made a loan on overvalued collateral because of the breach of the 2002 and 2003 contracts. Those contracts also contained a survival clause that
When the loan's repaid, what's the damage?
Your Honor, the damage is the diminution in collateral value. The bank made a loan on property that was overvalued, and it was overvalued because of the breach of that environmental warranty from 2002 and 2003. It's a direct causal relationship. If the parties had not been in breach, Warren Kiernan, and disclose the environmental contamination, the loan would not have been made. The property would not have been valued at $5.4 million. It would have been valued at zero. And the complaint pleads that drop in collateral value as a separate loss, separate and apart from the loan. The remedies under that contract provide that the bank, for breach of environmental warranties, may seek equitable relief. And they also say that such claims survive the payment and satisfaction of the indebtedness. So it's a separate damages claim that the contract provided for, and the court was in error in dismissing those claims and finding no well-pled damage. I see that I have less than a minute left, and I would like to reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Edward Siglius for the appellant defendants in the case. I'd like to address the arguments that were raised by appellant's counsel. With respect to the whole issue of joint venture, And I think Justice Jacobs hit it on the head. The equitable tolling doctrines that are invoked in order to avoid the impact of the statute of limitations that would otherwise apply, notwithstanding a latches argument that the plaintiff makes, is really the basis upon which this whole appeal is taken. Without a finding that potentially there is a joint venture, then any of the fiduciary duties that might be implicated in the tolling doctrines really wouldn't apply. And there's a couple points I want to make with regard to this issue of joint venture, and I think where we need to start is in the complaint, because as we pointed out in our brief, there are really only two paragraphs that even talk about this so-called joint venture that Kiernan and DeSabatino purportedly entered into prior to the time that they signed the September 2004 agreement.
Mr. Seglius, excuse me for interrupting, but before you get into that, and we do want to hear it, we're told that there's also a separate non-fiduciary duty claim of fraudulent concealment.
Yes, sir.
What is, you know, how do we react to that?
Yeah, the fraudulent concealment argument is interesting because what the plaintiff really, or the appellant really need to demonstrate within the complaint itself is something more than the mere conclusory allegations to which they cite. Fraudulent concealment requires an affirmative act of concealment by the defendant, Kiernan in this case, or one of the other defendant entities, and an actual artifice that prevents the plaintiff from gaining knowledge of some fact intended to put the plaintiff off the trail of inquiry. So with respect to the allegations in the complaint, and as the Chancery Court pointed out, there simply aren't any. What would have to have been alleged and what was not alleged is that Kiernan and the other defendants knew certain information, notwithstanding the knowledge of the information and the materiality of that information, they worked in some fashion to prevent DeSabatino from learning that information. Well, the information that would have been critical, according to DeSabatino at the time, could only be the 2002 environmental report. That report was clearly disclosed in the August 8, 2004 email.
Well, what about the distinction between the existence of the report and the substance of it, the contents?
Well,
the argument is that there was a duty to disclose the contents, or to put it differently, by not disclosing the contents, that was sufficient to constitute an artifice or an affirmative act of concealment.
In the absence of a fiduciary duty, Your Honor, and within this arm's-length transaction, there's no duty on behalf of Kiernan to tell DeSabatino, by the way, you know that 2002 report that I mentioned in my August 8th email? Well, that report actually says the following. I mean, it would be a matter of Kiernan's interpretation whether that's good or bad, because, frankly, the report is neutral. The report, the 2002 environmental report, is relatively neutral.
Could you explain that?
Yes, certainly. It doesn't say, Your Honor, that in fact there are environmental problems with the project. In fact, within that report, it says the following. There is a definition which I think is important, and it talks about, right on page 6, the purpose of the report, and it talks about the term recognized environmental conditions, and then it goes on to talk about the release of potential release or actual release or potential future release of petroleum products, things of that sort. In the findings and conclusions of the report, which only are a page long on page 18, there is no discussion of the term environmentally recognized conditions. It simply doesn't exist. In fact, in the findings and conclusions, there is no discussion at all about hazardous substances, capital H, capital S, which is talked about, for example, in the agreement. And there's no other discussion that, in fact, there is a so-called, and this is my words, environmental problem. We hear the plaintiffs, the appellants, talk about environmental problems, But in fact, on page 18, what it talks about is the fact that there are some old tires there. There are some drums. They might contain petroleum products, not a conclusion. There are some stains on a concrete floor in a building, and there might be some asbestos within this building. These are all possibilities. They're not actualities. And then what the report says, there is a large amount of materials, as listed above, that may, not do, but may present hazards if improperly removed and disposed. So there is not an environmental problem per se.
Are you arguing that this is not material information?
Well, I'm not saying it's not material.
Then if it was material, there would be a duty to disclose it, at least if there were a fiduciary relationship.
Well, that's a good question, Your Honor, especially in view of the fact that DeSabatino didn't want to even look at the report, apparently, prior to the closing. So whether it was material to him or not might be something entirely different.
Might be, might not be.
Might be.
Issue of fact.
I don't think so, Your Honor. The reason I say that is that the report itself was disclosed.
The existence of it was disclosed.
Yes, correct. Is there a further obligation than to actually sit DeSabatino down and tell him? Well, that possibility could only occur, and I'm only calling it a possibility, in the event that, in fact, there is a joint venture between the parties. But there isn't.
Isn't that a question of fact that has to be analyzed at a trial?
The joint venture, Your Honor?
Yes.
Well, the problem is, again, that the allegations, and this gets me back to where I was a little bit earlier, on paragraph 89, page 16 of the complaint, the only allegation is, by virtue of their contemplated relationship as co-venturers. Well, I'm not even sure why the term co-venturers is being used, because the agreement itself is not a joint venture agreement. It's simply an agreement. It's simply a transaction in which a legal entity created by DeSabatino and a legal entity created by Kiernan agreed to buy the assets of an entity called Sunrise, and the underlying asset of that entity was a piece of real estate. Is that a joint venture transaction? Well, I think, according to In Re Coffee, I don't think it is.
Let's assume that you're right, and there was no joint venture relationship created until the 2004 agreement was formally executed. From that point forward, there was a fiduciary duty or fiduciary relationship, was there not?
Yes, there would be. I think you're right.
Whatever disclosures were required by such a relationship should have been made.
I believe that, yes, under a fiduciary relationship, there would be an affirmative duty to disclose material information. With respect to that issue, unless one of the tolling doctrines applies, they're still out of court because they waited 4 years, 1 year beyond the limitations period, to make the claim. So then the question would become, well, was the applicable limitations period tolled because of something Kiernan did or did not do?
So you're saying there would be a cause of action predicated on a fiduciary duty or breach thereof, and there would also be a cause of action in contract based on the Section 11 of the 2004 agreement.
I don't know that there would be a cause of action, but at least with respect
arguably.
Well, for the plaintiffs, at least with respect to the issue of whether there might be a cause of action, yes, there might be at that time based on the idea that there was a fiduciary duty established between the parties.
Okay, the entire case from the plaintiffs or from your point of view rests on whether or not the statute of limitations was told.
I don't think ours does. I think that even if it's true that there is a fiduciary duty established on the date that they execute the agreement for the purchase of Sunrise, the question would still become, because there's a three-year limitation on a breach of fiduciary duty claim, the question still is whether one of the tolling doctrines applies. We've talked about the fraudulent concealment, which would require some affirmative act by the defendant to actually try to conceal information. Well, the fact that he didn't disclose it or sit DeSabatino down and tell him about the contents of the report, that's not the type of active concealment or artifice that I think would support a fraudulent concealment argument. With respect to the issue of equitable tolling, although the plaintiff can rely on his fiduciary, it still requires reasonable diligence on behalf of DeSabatino. As far as we know, based on the facts pled, and assuming that they're true in the complaint, DeSabatino didn't really do anything with the property until 2007, thereabouts when he commissioned a report. And even then after that, 18 months into 2008, that's when he finally commenced an action against the defendants. So the whole issue of inquiry notice at that point in time, I think, is applicable, as well as under the equitable tolling doctrine, whether DeSabatino acted with any reasonable diligence. The Chancery Court found, and I think properly so, that notwithstanding the existence of the 2002 report and the knowledge of that, and notwithstanding his right under the 2004 agreement to actually investigate the site, he was allowed to go out there and do digging and other investigation, environmental testing, if he so chose, for the purpose of determining whether there were any issues. There is no evidence and there's no allegation that he did that. And, in fact, there's no allegation that Mr. DeSabatino went to the property at all to do any due diligence. So with regard to the issue of due diligence and whether he sat on rights that he may have had, there isn't really anything to tell us that he took any affirmative or active step to try to find out more about the property and whether there was, in fact, I'm going to call it an environmental issue.
That's really the critical issue here, isn't it? Whether Mr. Sabatino exercised reasonable diligence?
I think it is. I don't think that, frankly, I mean, this is my own surmise, but from what I can tell, there's no indication that he took any particular interest in the property until such time as he had now acquired it for himself after Kiernan was out.
To put a little more flesh on the bones, or to get back down to earth, isn't the issue that we're contending with whether once the joint venture agreement was signed, Mr. DeSabatino had some obligation to at least read the 2002 report, and if he was alarmed by it, take some action to follow up, or that whether he wasn't and was legally entitled to rely, in this case, on the silence of his new partner, Mr. Kiernan?
I think that's correct. What happened, I think, was there was an acquisition of a piece of real estate with the intention of developing at some later point in time. And by the way, the Brown parcel that we're talking about is only one section of the entire transaction, which is made up of several other pieces of property. So we're talking about one part. So to say that the entire property can't be developed simply isn't true. But getting back to what you pointed out, Justice Jacobs, there is no indication that until Kiernan was out of the picture because Sabatino had now acquired entirely the ownership of Sunrise, and then even sometime afterwards that he said, okay, now I'm ready to start to develop this. Well, this is almost 3 years after the property was acquired. If you buy an asset, and we're not talking about perhaps a homeowner who simply was not very sophisticated, we're talking about businessmen who are involved in a sophisticated transaction, who have an understanding of what is involved in real estate development.
So you're saying that in terms of the degree of due diligence that has to be exercised, that depends on the level of management power and responsibility that the plaintiff investor has under whatever the business arrangement is, correct?
Yes, and I think he has an equal right. There's nothing to indicate that Kiernan, there's an allegation or at least a discussion in the briefing about Kiernan having superior knowledge. He may have known of the existence of the Phase 1, but beyond that, there's no evidence that he knew anything more than that. And certainly there is no allegation that under the agreement that they entered into in September 2004, that Kiernan took an active role, whereas DeSabatino took more of a passer investor role. There's no allegation there either. So if we're going to call them joint venturers, and I'm not going to call them that, but if that's what the plaintiff's position is, then they are co-equals. They both have an equal right to investigate and do the things that are necessary to be done to develop this property. And that simply doesn't, there's nothing to indicate that Kiernan tried to keep DeSabatino away from.
Well, but your argument goes further. It's not only is there an equal right, but there's an equal duty.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. And I think that under the documents, and in particular, because if this is Sunrise Ventures we're talking about. If, for example, after this agreement was executed pursuant to paragraph 9, the inspection of the property, the buyer found through testing that there was some problem with the land, it could have gone back to the sellers, who are no longer in the transaction, two legal entities. And if the buyer is not satisfied with the results of any such inspections for any reason, buyer may terminate this agreement by written notice to seller delivered at any time prior to closing, in which case neither party shall have any further obligation or liabilities hereunder. So when we're talking about separate legal entities that were involved, and setting aside people for a moment, there's nothing in these agreements that said that Mr. DeSabatino could not, and through his DeSabatino Ventures, could not avail himself of the rights under the agreement by which he then could conduct his own inspections. Frankly.
But nobody contends that. Essentially, the other side is saying that in these circumstances, Mr. DeSabatino had a duty to be more diligent than he was.
I think the plaintiffs are saying that he has essentially no duty, that he can expect a duty from Kiernan, but he himself had no duty or obligation to really do anything. He was entitled to rely, if you will, on Kiernan's silence.
And
as an expression that the property was fine, and I just don't think that's
okay,
even
and,
plausible.
And your response, if I understand it right, and if I don't, please correct me, is number one, if Mr. DeSabatino were a shareholder in a corporation, a passive shareholder with no management responsibilities, then perhaps in that role he would have no duty.
Yes, I don't know.
Yes. Or not.
I think that's possible, Your Honor. I can't say because I'm not as familiar with corporate governance issues as the court is, certainly. But in the instance where, for example, if I was just a shareholder of General Electric and all I could do is rely on the public disclosures that they make, then it's difficult for me to do anything further because I can't really get into the company.
That's what I meant to ask. And changing the hypo a little bit, if Mr. DeSabatino was simply a purchaser of a home, would the same be true? That is, would that also be your position?
I think that there would be a certain entitlement to reliance in connection with that arm's-length transaction based on the disclosures, because as any homeowner, for example, the seller is required, actually, before the transaction to make material disclosures about anything that he knows that's materially wrong with the premises.
But and then we get to this case, which is where the investor or the purchaser has an active management role.
It's that plus it's the disclosure that actually was made, the 2002 report, for example, because I think the whole thing hinges on that. I think the plaintiff can't make their case without saying, if only I had known about the contents of the 2002 report in advance, then there is something I could have done.
Well, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Your argument is once Mr. DeSabatino knew about the existence, then in this business environment, in this structure, it was his obligation to find out what the document said.
I think that's true, and I think that's even true in the homeowner's case or the shareholder's case. Because I don't think in any of those instances where the disclosure has been made about a report which contains information that relates to the asset or, in this case, the real property.
You're saying a shareholder of General Motors who's told about the existence of such a report would have some duty to ferret out what the report says?
Well, there's a whole body of case law, of course, that is devoted to that and what the plaintiff's obligations are or are not. But in the ordinary transaction, I think that there is some duty on behalf of a purchaser, whether it be stock or real estate in this instance, to read the disclosures that have been given.
Thank you. Your time is
Thank
up.
You.
And you have 45 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. There was no suspicion on September 17th of environmental problems. The environmental report was never delivered by now Mr. Kiernan's, Mr. DeSabatino's clear fiduciary after September 17th. In fact, the sales agreement purely provided, and this is part of the fraudulent concealment, that the Phase 1 report will be delivered after closing. Well, after closing, all of the momentum had shifted. And remember that Mr. Kiernan never disclosed, and this is in the complaint, ever disclosed the environmental report or its conditions to the lender. So as of September 17th, there is no reasonable suspicion from the circumstances for DeSabatino to go backwards and do due diligence. The loan's been made. The property's been acquired. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You. Thank you, counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement and take a short recess.